This is James Fleming in the NBC Newsroom in New York to introduce the men and women whose words and deeds made the news. This week's Voices and Events.
Voices and Events. The living record of history as it happened this week, compiled by the NBC News and Special Events Department. You'll hear Helen Hayes, Oscar Hammerstein, and Samuel Goldwyn, Joe DiMaggio and Governor Dewey, the voices of Graham McNamee and Walter Houston, these and many others. Now, your Voices and Events editor, James Fleming.
The Prime Minister of Northern Ireland came to our shores this week, Sir Basil Brooke. He's the man to whom New York's Mayor O'Dwyer gave the back of his hand on St. Patrick's Day. We sought out Sir Basil, asked him, in view of your publicity, what sort of reception have you been having?
Wonderful. Everybody has been kindness itself. My only trouble is that I, unfortunately, can't be here longer to fulfill all the very kind invitations I've received.
Now, Mr. Prime Minister, is it true that you banned all the St. Patrick's Day parades in Northern Ireland?
No, entirely untrue. There was one out of about a dozen parades which was banned because of possibility of disturbance. And the first duty of a government is to see that law and order is maintained. I actually passed myself through a parade near my own home. This is pure exaggeration and is a bit of propaganda. That's all I need to say about it.
I take it then, Sir Basil, that you're disposed in a friendly way toward St. Patrick?
Oh, yes, he's an Ulsterman.
St. Patrick, an Ulsterman? Now, that could start an argument a prudent man would do well to stay out of. Thank you, Mr. Prime Minister.
Dateline, Moscow, 11:30 New York time, Tuesday morning. A Soviet communique broke the news.
An American plane of the B-29 type, said Vyshinsky, had flown 13 miles into Latvia, fired on a Russian fighter, and been fired on in return. But a check of U.S. air commands in Europe revealed no B-29 had flown in the Baltic area. Missing was a four-engined American Navy privateer with 10 men aboard. The ship had been unarmed, its only weapon a pistol worn by the pilot. From Kastorp Airfield near Copenhagen, a score of planes set out to search Baltic waters for a trace of this Navy ship. That's a C-54 roaring into the dawn, recorded on the scene in Denmark. Nearby, in an improvised ready room, other American crews were briefed for the search. This is how it actually happened at Kastorp Field.
Okay, fellas, you're going out to Area B. Your radio frequencies and facilities remain the same.
You went that report then during the hour, is that right?
That's right, on the hour and sooner if you sight any questionable objects that you feel we ought to look at.
Well, how's the weather out there right now?
Weather is good. You'll have 1,000 to 1,500 feet in 3 to 6 miles. We'd like for you to get airborne as soon as you can and stay out as long as you possibly can.
These men have scoured 60,000 square miles of the Baltic without announcement of success in the search. Pravda now concedes it was our Navy plane that was fired on, and the Moscow newspaper boasts that, quote, the impudent fellows got a proper lesson, unquote. Official Washington has so far been silent in this grave affair, but some legislators have been outspoken, among them Senator Stiles Bridges.
We can't afford to have young American boys shot down in cold blood without a chance to defend themselves, like rats in a trap. Let's let Joe Stalin know that if he takes a shot at an American plane, that it'll be prepared to shoot back. It won't bring on war. Such an attitude on our part will have a tendency to prevent war if Mr. Stalin knows we mean business.
This tragic incident of the Navy plane gave somber emphasis to the words of our top military man, General Omar Bradley. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff this week reminded Americans of some commitments.
Whether we recognize it or not, the American people have decided to hold and save Western Europe for the free world. Although we may not have realized it at the time, we Americans have been making this decision for the past 9 years.
For Americans who would join an organization in pursuit of peace, there was a wide choice this week.
Somehow it seems the men who feel a mission to save the world are themselves at war with one another. For example, the United World Federalists with Cord Meyer Jr. as spokesman, the American Committee of United Europe with Alan W. Dulles as a representative, and the Citizens Committee for UN Reform, Eli Culbertson chairman. Put them all together in front of the same microphone with Mrs. Eleanor Roosevelt as referee, and this is what happens.
I'm not going to advocate such the course that you advocate, Mr. Culbertson,
which,
as I understand it, before the House Foreign Affairs Committee was preventive war.
You should go and study more in Harvard to understand the definition of preventive war. If you knew as much about preventive war as I know about bridge, I would feel more comfortable. Now, I'll tell you about preventive war. I consider that a preventive war is a crime against humanity if the United States engages in that war.
Then what are you advocating specifically?
Well, I'll tell you in a moment if you let me finish. What I'm advocating is the establishment of a world authority, not the kind of a utopian world state that you advocate, but a practical, feasible world authority. And if then Soviet Russia keeps on defying this world court and defying the world, I am advocating a world legal ultimatum.
And
That's not a preventive war.
And if the ultimatum is turned down?
Then I send the sheriff and have the world court fix them up. I am not trembling before Uncle Joe.
But if you
We should have sent the sheriff long time ago.
Ah, yes. But
we wouldn't have these atomic bombs threatening America.
Culbertson,
what you advocate is appeasement. No. One of the real reasons that we're losing today is we tremble in our boots every time that Tavarish Stalin is frowning.
I beg your pardon, sir. I have never been afraid of Russia or Stalin. But I do believe that you have to look at this question from the point of view of other people as well as our own point.
What other people? The Politburo?
The whole world.
They are with us, Mrs. Roosevelt.
No, you have not got at present you have not won the struggle of the democracies and communism throughout the world.
That's perfectly correct.
You will not have won that until our democracy is so good that there is no chance of world revolution anywhere in the world.
And this week may well go down in history as one during which Senator Joseph McCarthy was relatively silent. But the nominal head of the Republican Party did speak out on the subject of foreign affairs. At Princeton, New Jersey, Governor Thomas E. Dewey underlined the seriousness of the times with a warning to his own party. Governor Dewey.
Before any Republican rejoices at the possible shipwreck of the foreign policy of the Democratic administration, he should remember that we are all in the same boat. At the same time, the Democrats should remember that the administration invited this trouble by allowing bipartisan cooperation to deteriorate, and they should not forget that it was their own party that had to clean out a large collection of its own undesirables. The world situation is desperate enough to call for largeness of spirit and genuine cooperation between both parties in foreign affairs, however much they may contest on domestic issues.
Luckily, in the midst of this perpetual crisis we're learning to live with, relief arrives this week in the form of another season of Abner Doubleday's favorite pastime. How to convey what baseball means to America, the thrill of opening day? There once was a man who could do it. His name was Graham McNamee. The very sound of his voice above the cheers on opening day was something to remember and cherish.
This is Graham McNamee speaking, reminding you, in case you've forgotten, that it's baseball time. Yes, the parade's on its way to the old ballpark for the opening game, because this is the day that 150,000 grandmothers decide to die each year so that Johnny can get off to go to the funeral. Long may they live to die and die again, say I. For their imaginary tragedy serves a very good cause indeed.
That was the voice of Graham McNamee a score of years ago. There's another voice on NBC this year that means baseball at its best, that indomitable Yankee, Joe DiMaggio. Joe, how does baseball shape up at the half-century mark? How do you think they'll finish?
In the American League, I naturally like the New York Yankees. The Boston Red Sox are going to furnish all the fight, believe me. And I think for the third spot, Detroit is going to be there, and they're going to battle all the way, and I'm looking for Cleveland and Philadelphia in that order. Now in the National League, I haven't seen all the teams down at Florida, but I will say the team that looks best to me right at this particular time is the Brooklyn Dodgers. And I'm going to pick them to win the pennant.
Thank you, Joe DiMaggio.
This week, a Supreme Court justice stepped down from the bench momentarily to join the ranks of authors.
His name, of course, is William O. Douglas. You know, when a man writes a book, his publisher expects him to get in there, hustle, make some sales. He has to have a ready pen for an autograph, a ready anecdote for his speaking engagements. Mr. Justice Douglas has proved himself a good salesman for his book of Men and Mountains. Here he is in action at a luncheon in New York, telling of his latest mishap up in the mountains.
The scene of this nasty accident was 70 miles back in the mountains. The problem after the injury was to, my friend Elon was to go out and get somebody to help him carry me into town. He brought a couple of men with him, and one of these men got down on the ground next to me, and I said, "Who in the world are you?" And he said, "I represent the Associated Press." Well, in spite of all my pain and suffering, I had to laugh. Here was the Associated Press, 70 miles in the backwoods of the state of Washington, and this guy had a camera. And I said, "How in the world did you get here so fast?" "Oh," he says, "my wife and I were up here on a hiking expedition taking pictures." And he said, "This is a big scoop for me, the only newspaper man in the woods." Well, as a result, a newspaper man finally got by the nurses in the hospital about 2 weeks later, came into my bedroom and said, "There's a question that I want to ask that may be a little embarrassing, but I just got to ask it." And I said, "Shoot." He said, "Was this accident a publicity stunt?"
One begins to suspect that had Justice Douglas chosen to forsake the law, he might very well have been our new Will Rogers.
This week, Carmen was married in Madrid, but not to Escamillo.
No, it wasn't the lady in the opera, but the daughter of the Spanish dictator who was wed. In one of the fanciest affairs in the history of Iberia, Carmen Franco married the Marqués de Villaverde. We are just outside the Royal Chapel of El Pardo Castle. The band's playing and the bells are ringing as the bridal party arrives. A few minutes later, Franco's daughter, in a firm, determined voice, repeats her vows before the primate of all Spain. You'll note that it's the groom who seems to be nervous. And so they were married. With the Generalissimo leading the way, his new son-in-law and Carmen following, the wedding party repaired to a palace banquet room, where 800 guests drank champagne and marveled at their good fortune. Nothing quite so sumptuous, they said, since the Duke of Alba got his daughter married. As for Carmen, she seemed very happy.
You are listening to Voices and Events. That's the sound of the great bank of teletypes here in the newsroom. Correspondents all over the world reporting the event shaping our destiny in this mid-century year. At home and abroad, correspondents of the NBC News and Special Events Department, in addition to reporting the news, have been recording the actual voices of the people who made the news as they made it, so that on these Sunday programs, you may hear the sounds of history in your own home. Again, from the NBC Newsroom in New York, here is your Voices and Events editor, James Fleming.
This week, in a rare public statement, a famous son told us of life with his famous father. John D. Rockefeller, Jr. was celebrating his 50th year as a member of the Chamber of Commerce of New York. As he received the Honor of Life membership, he spoke in an intimate and affectionate way of his father. Mr. John D. Rockefeller, Jr.
To save you from the garrulous ramblings of one in the upper age bracket, I have committed to writing the few words that I am about to say. I was my father's only son. It had always been taken for granted that on the completion of my education, I would go into his office to help him with his multifarious affairs. Thus, it came about that on the first Monday of October, 1897, having graduated from Brown University the previous spring, I entered my father's private office at 26 Broadway. From that time until the day of his death, my one desire was to help him in every way in my power. I was always as glad to black his shoes, to pack his bag, to act as the courier of family travels at home or abroad, as I was later to represent him in various of his interests, business and philanthropic. He never gave me any authority, any power of attorney, or any title. As my experience grew, his confidence in my judgment increased. Of that fact, he gave abundant proof in the large gifts which he made me from time to time, and which have enabled me with the passing years to continue in my own way the work for humanity throughout the world which he initiated.
Those were the words of John D. Rockefeller, Jr., specially recorded for this program at Williamsburg, Virginia.
Voices and Events reports on crime and punishment in the nation.
First, crime. Months back, the United States Senate approved a resolution by Senator Estes Kefauver for an investigation on a nationwide scale of organized crime. A similar resolution was later introduced by Senator Johnson of Colorado. That was approved. But somehow, both resolutions were shunted aside by leading Senate Democrats. Then, a gunman and a Kansas City Democratic boss were shot to death in a political club in that city. In Washington, Republicans, including Senator Kemp of Missouri, moved in to make political capital.
The bloody killing of Bonaggio and Gargatta are merely the most recent manifestation of the unholy alliance between politics and the underworld in Kansas City. The present crime wave can be stopped if we have adequate enforcement of the existing laws.
And Republican Senator Wary of Nebraska was no less emphatic.
The recent killing of a Kansas City, Missouri Democrat political boss would seem to offer a fertile field for the projected congressional investigation. But if the congressional investigation is to be used for political purposes, to whitewash big city Democrat political machines, nothing will be gained for good government. Let Congress investigate the hoodlums of the underworld and the overworld, and let the chips fall where they may.
Yes, it was quite obviously time for the Democrats to act, and they did, with Senator Scott Lucas clearing the way for a joint investigation to be conducted by a special committee.
I cannot emphasize it too strongly when I say there is absolutely no justification for the cry of politics raised by Republican members of the Senate in the case of the proposed investigation of organized crime by a special committee to be named by the Vice President of the United States. The country has confidence in the Vice President. The American people know that Alvin Barkley will appoint a group of senators who will carry out a thorough and careful study of crime syndicates operating in interstate commerce.
Crime and punishment. The punishment for West Coast labor leader Harry Bridges after his conviction for perjury in San Francisco was a sentence this week of 5 years in prison. A hearing on revocation of his citizenship was put off until next month. When convicted, Bridges had said he was framed.
Been a frame-up right from the start.
Do you plan to fight it further?
That's my understanding, yes. We'll fight it on through. My experience has been when you're in the trade union movement, why, you have to expect anything.
And in Hollywood, 10 screenwriters under sentence for contempt of Congress were rebuffed in an effort to secure a Supreme Court review of their cases. This was the latest chapter in the story, which began with stormy scenes like this one in October of 1947.
We're going to get the answer to that question if we have to stay here for a week. Are you a member of the Communist Party? Or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party?
It's unfortunate and tragic that I have to teach this committee the
basic principles of America. The question is, have you ever been a member of the Communist Party?
I'm framing my answer in the only way in which any American citizen can frame his
then
answer
you denied,
to a question
then you,
which invades his, absolutely invades
then
his
you
life.
Then you refuse to answer that question. Is that correct?
I have told you that I will offer my beliefs, my affiliations, and
everything else
to the American public, and they will know where I stand, as they do from what I have written.
Stand away from the stand.
I have written for Americanism for many years, and I shall
stand continue. Away from the stand.
That was John Howard Lawson in an exchange with J. Parnell Thomas, himself in jail for payroll padding. Lawson and a co-defendant, Dalton Trumbo, were the two ruled against by the Supreme Court this week. In Hollywood, the other writers, including Albert Maltz, were angered.
With bitterness, with sorrow, and with shame as an American,
I wish to assert that the Supreme Court of the United States has failed its sworn responsibility. It is announced that in the future, no citizen can safely look to the courts for his civil rights.
Ring Lardner Jr. took the same view.
The crime for which the 10 of us are threatened with jail, if it was a crime, was a rather deliberate one. I think we can be frank about that. We didn't want to cooperate with this particular congressional committee in any way in what seemed to us an absolutely illegal invasion of free speech.
Their lawyer, Robert Kenney, didn't see how the court could overlook the case.
It seems incredible that the majority of the justices could have concluded that there was nothing for them to decide in this case. From the time it started 2.5 years ago, practically every law review in the country discussed the case and pointed out that the questions it raised demanded an authoritative answer.
But by a 6-2 decision, the court ruled, in effect, that neither Congress nor the courts is required to disregard the impact of world events. Neither the right of free speech nor the right to remain silent are absolute when there's a threat to the national welfare. So spoke 6 members of the highest court in the land.
Hollywood had another worry this week. Brows were furrowed as tycoons wondered what to do about that lusty infant of show business called television.
Let's begin this report with a comment from a man who's known for producing good films. On the NBC quiz Who Said That, reporter Robert Trout put the $64 question to producer Samuel Goldwyn.
Do you think television and Hollywood will be able to work together, or what will happen?
I'm positive.
You think they will?
Absolutely.
It won't be as much of a fight to destroy one or the other as some people say.
We know how in Hollywood. Television needs it.
No question about Hollywood's technical know-how, but in the salty language of Jimmy Durante, how are they going to get into the act? To make a first-hand check, your editor got aboard American Airlines' inaugural flight of their DC-6 coach to Hollywood and talked with industry leaders. Off the record, they seem anxious to make films for television, but they're worried about a man named the Exhibitor. He's the theater owner. TV is his competitor. If major studios alienate him, they lose a main source of revenue. That's their dilemma. But some major producers are already making TV films. Listen to this comment.
This is Hal Roach from Hollywood. Television's apparently taking some of the cream from the motion picture business. First, the attitude of the motion picture producer is to do nothing. Second, if they will, the motion picture business could completely dominate the television broadcasting. If you can't lick them, join them is the only logical solution.
Then, Mr. Roach, do you think Hollywood will remain the world's entertainment capital?
I'm sure it will.
Independent producers are very important to the film industry. Among the more enterprising are the King brothers at United Artists. Hyman King told me how he felt.
Well, we must all appreciate that we have gone through a period where a man practically had to be a genius to be a failure. And it has left its mark on all of us. We are far better equipped to make motion pictures for television than the television studios, inasmuch as we have every technical and artistic facility at hand and have had years of experience. And I feel that most of your studios eventually will make pictures for television.
A famous director saw in television a great challenge to be met. This is Frank Capra.
Anything I have to say on the subject, of course, is just off the cuff. I'm not an expert. I myself think that perhaps the audiences are staying away from movie houses because of television, because it just stands to reason that if you can get entertainment in your living room and you get it free, you're not going to go out and pay money for it when you can get it free. So what it amounts to is that the motion picture industry and those of us that are in it will have to get on our toes and meet this new challenge. But we're used to meeting challenges. Now comes the television, and this will probably be the greatest challenge of all, but I think in some way the motion picture industry will meet it.
But Hollywood, in this period of transition, might take comfort from the vitality of that fabulous invalid, the theater. It was this week that Broadway awarded its Oscars. They're called Tonys, in memory of famed director Antoinette Perry. And to award them, the First Lady of the Theater, Miss Helen Hayes.
You know, of course, I'm telling this mostly to the air audience, that these awards are not for best performance or best anything. They are for distinguished contribution to the theater. And now, without further ado, I'll get to the exciting part. I was allowed to to put these in order, the order in which I wanted to give them, and what do you know, I put the actors first.
For distinguished acting, awards to Shirley Booth and Sidney Blackmer, co-stars of Come Back, Little Sheba. You know, Mr. Blackmer's big scene in that play finds him depicting a violent state of inebriation. His acceptance speech made note of that.
I must say that this is an intoxicating moment for me. And in that connection, I would like to note that the time that I spent in Blake's and Sardi's and with Frank Case and the old Algonquin, with Billingsley and with Patty Clark, has now at last paid off.
Next, that gigantic hit, South Pacific, claimed most of the Tonys. Helen Hayes praises its director and co-author.
I'm almost afraid to make any comment on this next one. It'll get so personal. I'm just in love with him, that's all. Joshua Logan for his distinguished direction of South Pacific.
And a Tony for another member of the South Pacific team, for Richard Rogers, who wrote the music.
To get an award in the theater, from the theater, is about the best thing that can happen to a fella. Thank you very much.
And South Pacific lyricist Oscar Hammerstein thinks that the theater is here to stay.
We've been trying to get over the fact all season that the theater is not dying. It's a revolutionary thought. I always have a feeling when all of us are together, or a great many of us, in a room like this, that it doesn't need any argument at all. One gets the feeling of its vitality and the eternity of that vitality.
But within this fortnight, the theater has lost two of its irreplaceables, Kurt Weill and Walter Houston, who once combined their talents in a musical called Knickerbocker Holiday. And there was a song we won't soon forget, a September song.
When I was a young man courting the girls, I played me a waiting game. If a maid refused me with tossing curls, I'd let the old earth take a couple of whirls while I plied her with tears in place of pearls. And as time came around, she came my way. As time came around, she came. But it's a long, long while from May to December, and the days grow short when you reach September. And I have lost one tooth, and I walk a little lame, and I haven't got time for the waiting game. And the days dwindle down to a precious few. September, November. And these few precious days I'd spend with you. These precious days I'd spend with you.
The curtain falls, but the show goes on.
You have been listening to Voices and Events, the living record of history as it happened this week, compiled by the NBC News and Special Events Department. James Fleming was the editor and narrator.
Hear Richard Todd and Joan Fontaine on Theatergill tonight on NBC.